inside my head. Abruptly, the song ended. I was sweating and half slumped against the wall, a headache bashing around inside my skull and my jaw hurting from clenching tension. My upper lip felt wet. I reached up and touched a finger to it and was shocked and frightened to see that it was red. The music had made my nose bleed. "What the hell is going on?" I whispered. My words hovered in the golden silence of the yellow-painted kitchen, then melted into the knowledge that no matter what Dr. Reed said or what the tests showed, when I hit my head, I had done something more to myself than just scramble my senses. I washed my hand and face over the sink and dried myself on a paper towel. Then, when I was sure my nose was no longer bleeding, I put the pot of risotto in the fridge. I sat down to try to think through what was happening to me, because being hypersensitive didn't explain how music could affect me so strongly it gave me a blood nose, or why I kept smelling things that were not there, or why I associated those smells with certain people. I had been telling myself the smells were coming from some sort of scent bank in my brain that had been damaged and was randomly spilling its contents, but I felt suddenly absolutely certain that the smells were real, even if they were not coming from real things. Maybe whatever had happened to my brain had made my sense of smell so acute it could detect things that people normally couldn't smell. I thought of Dr. Reed's dirt and roses smell and her air of distracted sadness, wondering if I was smelling whatever it was that she was thinking of that made her sad. Then there was the coffee ground smell I always experienced when I was close to Da. It seemed to be permanent, so maybe it came from something in his essence that didn't change. But his pine needle scent came and went, as did the horrible ammonia smell and the caramelized sugar fragrance, but they must come from things he was thinking or feeling at certain moments. It was wild to imagine that thoughts and feelings could give off scents, let alone that a person's essential self might have a definite odor. The more I thought of it, the less crazy it seemed. Dogs always seemed to know when you were sad, and how could they know when you couldn't talk to them? It had to be that they could smell your sadness, because their sense of smell was much better than a human's. I began to feel excited, because if you could come up with a scent directory that connected feelings and thoughts with smells, it would be almost like having the means to read people's minds. But my elation faded when I remembered that overload from my extended senses had put me back into a coma, and look how a bit of bad music had affected me. Obviously, I was going to have to find some way to protect myself, or at least to control what I was taking in, and not just from my sense of smell, because all of my senses had grown more powerful and perceptive. I had used Luke as a buffer since I'd come home, and I figured he affected me differently because he hadn't grown into judging things yet. But I couldn't carry Luke around with me all the time, and even if I could, he was going to grow up and change. I got up to make myself a cup of tea, being careful not to concentrate on the tea. The rich, sweet steam plumed up into my face, and as I blew and sipped, I debated ringing Dr. Reed to tell her what I had figured out. But I was pretty sure I would sound like someone who sees Martians and has this whole rational-seeming theory about why no one else can see them. Because if there was something going on in my brain that a test would show, she would already have found it. Anyway, I wasn't sick, so I talked to a doctor. I was positive that the accident had done something to the part of my brain connected to my five senses, extending them in some way. All I had to do was to find some efficient way of controlling input before I blew a fuse. 6. By the time Jesse, Mum, and Luke came home in the afternoon, I had discovered that I could use one sense to distract another. For instance, I had forced myself to listen to some earwig music on the radio in Miranda's room and used mouthfuls of apple to shift my attention from hearing to taste just when it was getting unbearable. But it was a bit of a balancing act. Since the minute I started thinking about the apple, I started to swoon into that. More useful was the accidental discovery that if I imagined Luke, I could induce a milder version of the calmness I felt when I gazed into his face in reality. The only problem was that I ended up pretty well cut off from all other input. It wasn't that I could not see or hear, but I couldn't concentrate on anything else. I needed a more selective way of cutting down on input. When I heard the car pull up, I was pretty weary. I didn't want to face anyone, so I went back upstairs and climbed into bed. Fatigue rolled over me as I heard the door bang, and Jesse and Mum come into the hall, talking. A few minutes later, footsteps mounted the stairs. I guessed it was Jesse coming to check on me. I closed my eyes as I heard the door open. I couldn't detect the cut grass smell of his essence, but I could hear him, and because I was focusing on listening, I heard that his breathing was slightly quickened from the flight of steps he had climbed. I could even hear the rhythmic thud of his heart. The door creaked closed, and my last thought before sleeping was of how Jesse had felt when I touched him that first night home, as if he was so full of something that he might burst. I woke again when Serenity came to bed. It was dark, and from the silence of the house I guessed it must be late. She switched on the bedside lamp and draped her black scarf over the side of the lamp nearest to me to cut the glare. She undressed in the reflected glow from the white lily, and before she pulled on her nightdress, I noticed how skinny she looked. I saw all the knobs of bone along her spine and the delicate lines of her ribs. She seemed suddenly to feel my gaze and turned to look at me. "Are you okay?" She stepped towards me and brought the scent of fresh, wet violets with her. I was a bit surprised, because I couldn't smell the licorice that I had decided was her essence smell. "I'm fine," I said. "How is school?" She shrugged and climbed into bed. "What do they say about me?" I persisted, wanting to stop her switching off the light. She rolled over so that she could face me, like she used to do when we talked into the night. "There are a lot of rumors. Some of the girls are saying you're out of the coma, but you've forgotten everything. Sylvia Yarrow claims you've lost your marbles." "She would. What about the boys?" "Anyone in particular?" Serenity asked. I shook my head, deciding I wasn't ready to share my daydreams about Harlan Sanderson. We lay there, looking at one another for a while. "What's it like being in a coma?" she asked at last. I had the strange feeling that this was not the question she wanted to ask, but I answered her anyway. "Like nothing. I was awake, then I was asleep, and then I was awake. Bang, 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 like that." "Did you dream?" she asked in a queer, too casual voice, and just like that, I felt the darkness shift and quiver about her, and the violet smell faded into licorice and a sort of burnt oil smell. "I don't remember any dreams," I managed to say, wondering what she could be thinking or feeling that would so radically change her smell. Serenity reached over to switch her light out. I wanted to ask her not to, but I couldn't think of a good enough reason. Instead, I lay in the dark, listening to her breathe more and more slowly until she slept. I was on the verge of sleep when I heard a door slam. It sounded like an outside door, and I guessed that Mum was going for a walk, or maybe she was going to the all-night supermarket. I pictured her, walking along the street, hands pushed deep in Da's big coat, her hair a wild reddish tangle in the streetlights, spangled with little spits of rain. I wished I had the energy to get up and go after her, because I loved those surreal night trips where nothing was required of you but to wander along in Mum's dreamy wake. I turned over and let myself be soothed to sleep by the image of Mum walking along the supermarket aisles, making her eccentric additions to Jessie's list. I woke again, this time to daylight flooding into the room, and to Jesse playing his guitar in the shower. Serenity's bed was empty, and my clock said it was just after 9. I got up and went downstairs. Da was washing the dishes and talking with the phone cradled between his head and shoulder. 2 vans would be better," he was saying. He hadn't yet noticed me, so I allowed myself to focus warily on him. I smelled his coffee smell, and also the smell of molasses and new rope. I could also smell the real smells he was giving off, sweat from his morning run and dishwashing detergent. I reached out and got an apple from the fruit bowl in case I needed a distractor, and jumped when Dar suddenly gave a great burst of laughter. I glanced at him and smelled fresh stewed plums tart enough to make my mouth water. He still hadn't noticed me. It was funny, but before I had figured out what was happening to me, I felt no fear about dealing with anyone. Now that I knew what I was going to face, my palms were sweating at the thought of Dar turning around to talk to me. It was like being in some horrible experiment where you never knew where or when they were going to give you an electric shock. I tipped some muesli from the box on the table into a bowl and poured on milk, keeping my eyes on the food, because the movement was sure to catch Dar's attention. As I felt him turn my way, I flashed him a quick, unfocused smile and spooned up my muesli. When I looked up again, he had turned to the window, still talking. There was a rusty squeak, and I turned to see Wombat ooze through the cat flap. I crooned him, and he glided over and started to weave circles around my legs. To my amazement, when he brushed against me, I distinctly smelled tuna and understood that he was producing the smell to let me know he was hungry. I laughed aloud and knelt down to pat him, fascinated to find that when he looked at me, I wasn't overwhelmed by his curiosity or feelings or thoughts. I felt quite simply his insistence that he needed feeding, clear as a statement, and absolutely connected to the smell of tuna. I got out a box of crunchies, wondering if the focused attention of humans overwhelmed me, because they were unwittingly sending everything they thought in a loud, unfocused jumble, whereas Wombat used his scent with the same precision as humans used words. He had probably always given off his specific sense statement when he wanted food, but we humans had only responded either to our knowledge that he needed feeding or to the insistent meow he had come up with to get our attention. No doubt he thought we were totally dim. This whole idea of animals using sense to communicate in the same way humans used words seemed tremendously exciting, because it suggested that maybe what had happened to me wasn't a damaging or altering of my senses, but the jolting to life of a section of my mind that humans had used at some point in their evolution, but had stopped using when they started to rely on language. I set down Wombat's food and stroked his head, noting the rich, salty smell he was now giving off, and clearly understanding that it communicated affection for me, or maybe for his food. "Why not?" Dar was saying, as I went back to sit at the bench. "It's nothing to us how many guests come, as long as the urban crew don't set some sort of limit." I realized then that he was talking to one of the band about the upcoming gig. He started to give off the ammonia smell, and I saw that he was frowning.
"I'm just saying we shouldn't expect too much."
Listening pause.
"Yeah?"
Another pause.
"Okay, then."
Dar put the phone down, but to my relief, he went back to the dishes as he asked how I was feeling. I said tensely that I felt good, and he flashed a smile over his shoulder, then pulled open the cutlery drawer and started drying knives and feeding them into their grooves. He seemed distracted, and I got up, deciding I'd been brave enough for now. But before I could take a step, Dar gave a soft exclamation and reached into his pocket to pull out a long envelope. He tore it open, and as he read, the ammonia smell grew so strong that it almost blotted out the coffee smell. "What's the matter?" I asked.
"Just a bill," Dar said lightly.
Pushing the letter into his pocket, he went back to drying the dishes. But the ammonia smell stayed strong. I crossed to the fridge and made a big business of putting the milk away, getting out orange juice and pouring myself a glass.
"School rang this morning," Dar said. "How do you feel about going back? You don't have to until you feel up to it."
Now there was a pine scent winding through the coffee grounds, but the strong ammonia smell persisted. I took a sip of the juice, trying to ignore the flavor. Then I turned and looked at the spot on the wall just left of Dar's ear, telling him that maybe it was time to go back. I felt afraid of facing all those kids and teachers, but at the same time, I wanted to get my life back to normal.
"Why don't you wait until next week? Start out fresh on a Monday," Dar said.
I drank some more juice. Then I said, "I guess I could call the school and ask them to give me some work to help me catch up." Dar had gone back to the sink, and I went on more easily without him looking at me. "Miranda or Serenity could bring it home."
"Sybil," Dar corrected, obviously wanting to make me laugh. Except I no longer felt like laughing at Serenity's desire to become Sybil.
I don't like that name much, I said.
Dar frowned a little.
Me either, but we have to respect her wishes.
Do we? I thought. Even when I feel there's something weird about her being so determined to change her name.
Dar's frown deepened as if I'd spoken out loud, but he didn't say anything, and neither did I.
7. The next week, I went back to school. I had prepared myself as best I could, practicing that shift of focus and being careful never to exactly look at someone who was looking at me. I had a pocket full of fast-dissolving mints, and I could always use Luke's image if it got too much. But I was determined not to resort to a total blockout unless I had no choice. I didn't want to cut the world out. I wanted to find a way to cope with it. I was pretty nervous, but the worst thing would be those first few minutes in class when everyone focused their attention on me. But I told myself that if I could get through that, the rest would be easy. I dawdled deliberately to avoid the early morning locker crush in the hallway, because the one thing that really scared me was the thought of being touched, and it would have been unavoidable in the scrum between classes. I had not found any way to lessen the impact of physical contact, and I couldn't imagine what would happen if a few people bumped into me at once. Maybe my brain would explode, like in this science fiction movie I once saw. I put my blazer in the locker, got out all of the books I would need for the day, and put them into my pack. It would be a pain to lug them from class to class. I didn't dare risk going back during the day. Finally, I made my way to the homeroom, which was also where I had English first class on Mondays. He hesitated outside the door, heart racing and palms sweating. I told myself I didn't have to go in if I didn't want. Everyone would understand if I changed my mind. Problem was, if I backed away now, I doubted I would ever be able to bring myself to try again. I took a deep breath, stuck a mint in my mouth, and entered the room. Everyone stopped everything and stared. I had to grit my teeth to stop myself reeling backwards. The combined attention of the class was almost overwhelming, like a physical wave crashing into me. Even looking down and concentrating on the mint I was sucking, I felt like about 20 pillows had simultaneously pounded me. Fighting nausea and panic, I managed to nod my head apologetically at the teacher without actually looking at her. Then I all but fell into the seat nearest the door. It was vacant, but Sylvia Yarrow was in the next seat, and my hand brushed her bare arm. I felt the burning surge of her corrosive nastiness, which was boiling out of a black lake full of despair and self-loathing. I don't know what I looked like in those seconds after I brushed against her, but Sylvia must have thought I was going to throw up on her because she drew back hastily. Now that I was looking at her, I could smell the sharply unpleasant stink of burning plastic that she was giving off. Rather than being repelled, I felt a great surge of pity for her. It was this that allowed me to get a grip on my senses. I concentrated on the mint and said, "Are you all right?" For a split second, her face screwed up, like she was going to burst into tears. Then she snapped, "Of course I'm all right, you idiot. You hardly touched me." She flounced off to sit in another seat. "What did you say to Sylvia just after you came in?" Jilly Roundtree asked, moving up to take Sylvia's spot after the homeroom teacher left. "She looked like you punched her in the stomach."
"Nothing," I said.
Jilly was giving off such a wonderful sea breeze scent, which vanquished the clammy despair left over from my glimpse into Sylvia. "Are you all right or not?" Jilly asked doubtfully.
"About half okay and half not," I said.
She was looking at me, so I pretended to rifle through my books, asking whether the timetable had changed much while I was away. Jilly sat back in her seat with a sigh. "It's like days of our lives in this place. You can miss months, and then you see one show and pick up where you left off. Nothing changes."
Mrs. Barker came in then. She made no more comment on my presence than a swift nod before outlining the work we were to do that period. I hardly heard her. There was a roaring in my ears, and I felt like someone had vitamized my innards, but I also felt shakily triumphant at having managed such an ordeal. My aim for the rest of the day was to be so dull and uninteresting that any curiosity about me would die an untimely death. Once I calmed down, I was able to concentrate on the class. I'd always liked English, and it went pretty much as usual, except that I didn't answer any questions or make any comments. I was too scared of drawing anyone's attention. The next session was maths, and I was surprised to discover that I enjoyed it. It was not just because everyone left me alone so they could concentrate on what the teacher was saying. It was the numbers themselves, how perfect and complete they were. Mathematics, I saw, could be like building a house out of light or music. I had always struggled before because numbers and calculations had seemed to have nothing to do with anything I cared about. But now I saw that numbers were literally the fabric of life. I was so absorbed in one mathematical problem that I didn't notice the class had ended until I dimly registered Jilly saying, "Earth to Scotty." I saw then that everyone was packing up, and I reluctantly started to close my own books. "So, what was it like?" Jilly asked. I glanced warily sideways, but instead of being trapped and hammered by her regard, the mathematical calculations I had been doing hung in my mind like a web, absorbing the overwhelming rush of information from my extended senses. "Hello," Jilly called with laughing exasperation. "Sorry, what did you ask me?" I stammered, trying to hold the web of calculations in my mind, but like a spider web in rain, it was breaking and fraying. I said, "How was it being in a coma?" "It was like a long sleep," I said distractedly. "Ah, but in that sleep, what dreams may come," crooned Jezebel Astor. I made myself look at her, but her attention did not hurt me either. Even though the web of calculations was falling apart, it was still absorbing the pressure of her regard. Belatedly, I remembered that Jezebel was the class clown, and if I wasn't careful, the next day the school would be doubled up over her imitations of me acting weird. So I said more firmly, "I was just asleep, and then I was awake." Luckily the bell rang, and Mr. Racket marched in right on time as usual, sending Jezebel scurrying back to her seat. Mr. Racket is the most punctual teacher in the school, and woe to you if you come late to his classes. It's what history does to a man. All those dates have made him scared he'll miss his own historic moment. The class was only a single period, but I was too elated by what had happened in maths to concentrate. It seemed to me that I had stumbled on the perfect way to screen the input from my extended senses. I was too exhausted to try doing complex calculations, but I tried counting and then simple equations, and both worked by absorbing input, though less effectively than the web. Other than what had happened in maths, the most interesting thing about the whole day was realizing how little I had really known people before the accident. I kept seeing things that I hadn't been capable of seeing before, 1,000 details of body language that I wouldn't normally have seen, fingers twitching or hands shaking or laughter hidden from anyone but me, a sudden sweat that told me someone was scared, or the slightest telltale intake of breath. I felt like some sort of super Sherlock Holmes who could see evidence and make connections that other people were unable to make. Then there was the intangible smells. Mostly, I had no idea what they meant. They made me aware that there might be hidden aspects to people I thought I knew. For instance, one of the class troublemakers smelled a lot like Luke after a bath, while a girl I had admired smelled so strongly of paint thinner that just being near her made me feel nauseous. Then there was Jilly, who I'd always quite liked, but whose delicious sea smell now attracted me so strongly that it was all I could do not to follow around like a puppy. The biggest shock happened at the end of the day. I had dawdled packing up in the last class to make sure that the locker passage would be relatively empty when I got there, so there was no one nearby to see me open my locker and find a note on staff room pink paper from Mrs. Barker asking me to see her. I was poring over the note and wondering why she hadn't just spoken to me in class that morning when I heard someone call my name. I looked up and my heart did a total flip, because coming along the hall was the incredibly handsome Harlan Sanderson. I dropped some books and bent to retrieve them to gain time to start counting.
So, how does it feel to be back, Alison? Alan asked, coming to stand beside me.
My knees shook as I straightened and looked into his beautiful green eyes, half obscured by the silky black fringe of his hair. I began, then a hideous stench hit me so hard that I stopped counting and reeled back against the locker in shock and revulsion. I could feel darkness fluttering at the edges of my vision like a ragged black bird, and I saw Harlan's eyes widen in puzzlement.
"That's the old charm, Hal,"
laughed a boy who had come to a nearby locker. I dropped the books again and fell to my knees, ostensibly to collect them. Now that I was not looking at Harlan, I couldn't smell the awful, rotten stench he'd given off. But I could not stay groveling on the floor. I struggled to my feet and turned to my locker so I would not have to look at him again.
"Are you all right?" Harlan asked.
I felt a bit dizzy," I heard my stammered response. I'd finished putting the books away, so I had no choice but to turn back to him. He looked sympathetic and said something, but the ghastly stench he emitted was growing stronger. Desperately, I pulled open my bag and began shoving books into it from the locker. Now that I was not looking at him, I was free to listen.
"Gave me something to give your sister," Alan was saying.
I had no idea what he was talking about. "You want me to give something to Miranda?" I hazarded, throwing him a quick look, then zipping the bag.
"The other sister,"
Harlan said. He took out a green flash drive and held it out. I all but snatched it and thrust it into my pocket. Then I shut the locker and babbled something about Mrs. Barker wanting to see me right away. I made for the staff room via the toilet block to rinse my mouth out with water. Even so, it still felt like my tongue and throat were coated in the slimy reek that had emanated from Harlan. It was only when I reached the bathroom that it struck me that he smelled even worse than Dr. Austin at the hospital. But how on earth could handsome, charming Harlan Sanderson, whom I had yearned after for a year, smell so bad? I was so rattled that it took all of my self-control to act normal when the teacher finally condescended to answer the staff room door. I guess I didn't quite succeed, because when Mrs. Barker came out, she gave me a searching look.
"I didn't mean you had to see me the second you got the note, Alison," she said. "You ought to have gone straight home tonight. You look quite pale."
I stammered that I was fine, but she ushered me to a bench seat outside the staff room and sat beside me, giving off the yeasty bread smell of her essence. It seemed so wholesome after what I had smelled in the locker hall.
"The reason I wanted to speak to you was to tell you that you've missed a couple of important tests," Mrs. Barker said. "I can't rerun them for you because they're education department tests, but I can request alternative papers. The only thing is you'll need to sit them in your own time. You could come in one day on a weekend and do both at once. How does that strike you?"
I didn't answer straight away because she had patted my arm. When her skin touched mine, I felt how much she liked me, not just as a student, but as a person. I was startled because while Mrs. Barker was my favorite teacher, I had never imagined she felt so strongly about me. Certainly it didn't show in her expression. That touch had told me that if she wasn't a teacher and I a student, we might have been close friends.
"What is it, Alison?" she asked gently.
I'm fine." I didn't dare look at her until I had managed to start counting again. She said, with a frown in her voice,
"Another alternative is that I could ask for an averaging of your previous tests."
No, I want to do the tests," I told her firmly, looking into her face, but reciting the 9 times table to myself so her attention wouldn't overwhelm me. "But I'll need a bit of time to prepare." She looked pleased.
"Of course. It will take a week or so to set it up anyway. I'll have to let the department know, and they'll want to organize an outside assessor to sit in. Then he or she will call me to work out a date."
She gave me a searching look.
"Are you sure you're okay? Your father said you were still suffering some reactions to your accident."
I smiled to think of Da preparing the way for me and felt better. "I think it's just getting used to being around so many people. I ought to be used to it with my family."
"You have a pretty special family,"
Mrs. Barker said warmly. She might have said more, but another teacher stuck her head round the staff room door and said there was a call. I had intended to phone Da to pick me up, so I could avoid the crowded home bus, but coming out of the school, I decided that what I really needed was some space to think about what had happened with Harlan Sanderson. I set off along the bus route, knowing I could hail the next bus if I needed to. The yellow afternoon light made the walls of houses and buildings look like crumpets saturated in honey, and there was a slight sweet-scented breeze blowing. I breathed it in and told myself that it was impossible Harlan Sanderson had smelled like that, which meant I must have been wrong to think smells were only associated with feelings and emotions or people's essences. Perhaps other things gave off smells too. Maybe Harlan had been thinking of a really awful sight. Or he might even be sick, and that was what I had smelled. I tried to focus better on what had happened by the lockers, but I was frustrated by my inability to think clearly about my changed senses. I just didn't seem to have the words to describe my impressions. It was like this book Dar read us one winter called 1984, about a future where the authorities were trying to control everything. One of their methods was to cut words out of the language. This was very clever because without words, people found they couldn't think about the things those words expressed. The word for love was taken out, and people stopped being able to love. The book was saying that the most basic things were hard or impossible to do without the words to express them. I felt I wouldn't be able to think properly about what had happened to me until I could find words to think with. The trouble was, there wasn't some book or teacher I could go to for help. I might have asked a best friend for advice, but although I got along fine with the other kids at school, I'd never really been close to anyone. I hunched my shoulders and pushed my clenched fists into my pockets, only to find the flash drive Harlan had given me. I fished it out and examined it closely. There was nothing to say what it contained. It was the cheap, generic kind you could get at any newsagent. I had two of them in my locker. The oddest thing about it was that Harlan was giving it to Serenity. He wasn't in any of her classes, but he had said someone asked him to give it to Serenity, so maybe a teacher had asked him to pass it on, because I was in his class. I put it back into my pocket and tried to think of how I would go about telling someone what had happened to my senses. At the simplest level, I could see, hear, smell, taste, and touch a lot better than other people. But smell and touch had gone far beyond what those words usually meant. If I had to describe it to someone, I would say it was as if you'd always had really bad eyesight, only you didn't know it. Everything would be unfocused and blurred, but you'd think that was how it was meant to be. Then, one day, someone handed you glasses that gave you 20/20 vision. For the first time, you'd see what people looked like. You'd see their expressions, and you'd realize there were a whole lot of things people said in body language rather than in words, which you hadn't seen. So, you would understand people and what they were about much better than before. It wasn't like you'd suddenly become wise, but only that understanding people better was a natural consequence of seeing better. The world itself would be more clear and precise, and therefore more complex, but you would be able to handle it because seeing better would mean that you could respond better and more accurately. It would tire you to begin with, seeing so much more than before, but after a while you'd get used to it. That's what I told myself. 8. After the bus trip from hell the following morning, I decided I had been wise to walk the previous night, though Dar and the others had been on the verge of panicking when I had walked in so late. I felt pretty bad because I hadn't thought that they would be concerned, and I ought to have. They had boggled a bit when I told them I walked home because I needed some fresh air, but no one said it was a stupid idea or scolded me for being inconsiderate. Since the accident, everyone had been kinder to me than usual. Maybe they thought I would fall into a coma again if they upset me. I had told them I was going to walk home every night for a while, but I needed the exercise and, again, they just accepted it, though Dar reminded me to call if I got tired. I could just about tolerate the morning bus rides, I had decided, because I could get in a corner seat before the bus filled up and stare out the window the whole time, then get off after everyone else. But the night bus ride would kill me, with all those jostling kids bumping up against me. especially after being around people all day at school. The walk also allowed me to use my magnified senses on inanimate things without worrying how anyone would react. One night, I caught sight of a leaf waving in the wind, and another night it was a patch of ivy growing up the side of a building. Both times, I had let my senses go into them, just as I had done with the risotto, without anyone paying any attention to me standing transfixed by such a small thing. Of course, there were no small things now. That was the point. It was like everything had an immense story to tell. Suddenly, I was listening. It didn't always happen when I was alone, though. Midweek, I got a stone out of my shoe in class. As I looked at it, I began to feel I was understanding the stoneness of the stone. It was incredibly alien, but also wonderful and somehow thrilling. And I realized the teacher was shouting at me for not paying attention. She had started out mildly, Jilly told me later, but I had acted like I was deaf, and she'd got mad because she thought I was mocking her. Teachers hate to be mocked. Some of them are so paranoid you have to make sure not to do anything they might think is mockery. The weird thing was that at some level I had paid attention, and I was pretty certain that, if I wanted, I could sit down and write out the whole of any lesson I sat through, almost word for word. But it didn't seem like a good idea to admit to that just then. Walking home the night of the stone incident, I realized that if I thought about anything that had happened since the accident, I could remember it so vividly that it was like reliving it. As far as classes went, I could recall anything that had been said, any passage that had been read, any question that had been discussed, just by thinking about it. The trouble was that remembering in this way took almost as long as the event itself. I'd been really nervous about bumping into Harlan after what happened the first day by the lockers, but at the same time, I wanted to see him again, just to prove to myself that I'd been mistaken. I couldn't believe the one time he had spoken to me and shown an interest. I had to have some sort of scent meltdown. I hoped that Harlan had put my peculiar behaviour down to nervousness because, nice as he was, he had to be aware of how he affected girls, especially mousy girls like me. But I didn't see him the whole week, even in English, and by Friday I had realised he must be sick, and that this really could be the reason for his awful smell. He'd always been away a fair bit, and although rumour said his rich parents travelled a lot and took him along, hiring tutors to keep him up with his schoolwork, it might even be that he was having some sort of ongoing treatment. When he didn't come in my whole second week back, I was even more certain I was right. I had given Serenity the flash drive, telling her Harlan had passed it on. She had taken it without surprise, but when I asked who it was from, she told me to mind my own business. So much for sibling communication. Friday of the second week, I had sport. The school had advised against it the first week, but I'd said I was fine when the school nurse asked, so I was given permission. I knew that was a mistake when Mr. Eckbert announced we were playing a game of tag. After about 20 minutes of being tagged by other students and having their emotions and weird images hammer me whenever they touched bare skin, I felt as jarred and bruised as if the whole class had run over me in jackboots. I couldn't even protect myself from their attention, because it was almost impossible to count with Mr. Eckbert shouting out our individual numbers before he yelled instructions or admonishments. Each time someone bumped me, I had to clench my teeth to stop myself crying out. In the end, I said I had a terrible headache and asked if I could go to sick bay. Mr. Eckbert was famous for refusing to accept kids' excuses to cut his classes. He had told us at the start of the year that more kids tried to get out of sport than out of maths or science, and that students would cut his class at their own risk. He glared at me suspiciously for a long minute, as if I might suddenly break down and confess that it was a hoax. Then suddenly, Jilly said, "Sir, she was just in a coma." He didn't look at her, but he waved me away. I stumbled gladly to the sick bay and palmed the Panadol the nurse gave me, saying Da had left it for me, feeling guilty about her candy-scented concern. Just before the lunch bell rang, I slipped out and went to the library. Couldn't face the thought of the halls and yard seething with lunchtime crowds. I meant to do some catching up, but I couldn't keep my mind on my workbooks. I kept thinking about the failure of my plan to try to come up with a dictionary of smell. I had discovered that different people gave off different scents when they were thinking about the same thing. Of course, people talking about one thing could easily be thinking of another. Their attention wandered, so naturally you would expect variations in the intensity of smells or other intervening scents. But you would expect one smell to dominate, the smell that represented the way people felt about the main topic of the discussion. Yet whenever I got close enough to smell people having a conversation, I would find that nobody gave off the same smell as the others. Perhaps I'd been wrong to assume that people feeling sadness would give off the same smell. Maybe every single person had their own unique and individual set of scent responses. It made sense in a way, because no person reacted in exactly the same way to a situation. They were different, so their responses would be as well. One person's happiness would be different from another person's. The only correlation I had noticed was that good or innocuous scents appeared to be given off by people feeling good or positive emotions or thinking good thoughts, while bad scents were given off by people with negative thoughts or feelings. But I couldn't figure out if this also worked with people's essence scents. It seemed too simplistic to imagine that good people would smell good, while bad people smelled bad. A lot of scents couldn't even be categorized as good or bad, because what smelled bad to me might not smell bad to other people. Some people liked the smell of cigarette smoke or hot tar. Despite not being able to come up with anything like the dictionary I'd planned, my extended senses were helping me to understand people more than I could have imagined possible. Before the accident, I had relied on what people said they thought and felt and wanted to do. But every minute that passed, I saw and felt and smelled and heard details that showed me how amazingly rare it was for people to actually say what they meant. Words were like bubbles on top of the water. The truth was a shifting current beneath the surface, powerful and silent. No wonder the world was in such a mess, because even if you took out people wanting to deceive and only counted ordinary people, it would be almost impossible for anyone to agree to anything, what with everyone hiding what they felt and trying to guess what the other person was hiding. Add in different races and motivations and religions, and it was a miracle we hadn't all murdered one another eons back. I might have been depressed by that, except that the better I got at reading scents, the more able I was to pierce the evasions and silence and pretenses and see how people really felt. Even though I hardly understood what had happened to me, my attitudes and reactions to people had already deepened, and in some cases had changed completely. For instance, there was Jezebel Astor, who was always kidding around. I'd realized that she was much smarter than anyone else in the class guessed, despite her indifferent work and marks. I was attracted to her now, because, like Jilly, her essence scent was delicious. A mixture of fresh straw and hot honey. The second I started getting interested in her, I noticed all sorts of things, like she knew the answer to just about anything any teacher asked, though she hardly ever volunteered it. It didn't take me long to figure out that she was super bright, only she didn't want anyone to know. Of course, this didn't help to explain why she would want to keep her cleverness secret. Then there was Simon Wheels. I had thought of him as a complete Neanderthal, because he was always messing around and driving the teachers crazy with his antics. But the sweet bath soap smell he gave off had made me look at him more closely, and I soon saw that he was as soft and gentle as a baby underneath. That was why he let himself be persuaded to make trouble. Anyone who was nice to him could get him to do anything. Having teachers yell at him was exactly the wrong way to make him behave, because he hated being yelled at, so he messed around all the more, trying to make them laugh. There was nothing I could do, because no teacher would listen to me, even if I could explain how I knew about Simon. Besides, I wasn't sure it was my business. My thoughts shifted to numbers, and my growing ability to use them as a screen. The more difficult the mental calculations, the more dense the screen. Although it was hard to regulate, let alone concentrate, on what was going on beyond it, but it might be possible to build a permanent screen, which I could summon up at any moment. My idea was that the screen would have sections of more or less complex maths, and that would enable me to use whichever bit of the screen was appropriate, depending on what I had to block. The way I meant to build it was to do a series of complex calculations and memorize them, then attach some simpler calculations and so on, sort of like how you learned lines for a play or the way you created a quilt. What troubled me most was my inability to think clearly about my senses and the information they brought me. It was all the more aggravating because there were other things I could perceive that were far harder to pin down than smells. For example, the whispers I could hear in the air, sometimes softly and sometimes loudly, but never clearly, must mean something. I hadn't the slightest idea what, but I would hear them just as often when no one was around as when I was with other people, and I had the feeling they were sort of like an imprint on the air made by people just living and speaking in that space. Then there was a thing that happened around certain people. I saw it as a sort of distortion in the air, which was visible only because of what was behind it, like when you catch sight of your reflection in a flawed mirror. But the effect wasn't static. It shifted and shimmered like the air over a desert. Despite my frustrations, the one thing I was now sure about was that I didn't want my senses to go back to normal. Whenever I imagined waking up one morning and finding I was my old self, I remembered a film I saw about a man who had been virtually a vegetable his whole life until a doctor found a way to rouse him using some sort of experimental drug. The guy woke up and was like a child to start with, but he ended up being really brilliant, a genius, and also a really good person. The tragedy of the film was that the effect of the drug didn't last, and so he started to regress. The worst thing was when he realized what was going to happen to him. It wouldn't be such an extreme change for my senses to revert to normal, but even so, I wasn't sure how I could bear it. It would be like living in a world with all the lights switched out and having them suddenly switched on and then off again. You would be used to the dark, but unlike before, you'd know how things looked with the lights on, so you'd be forever longing to see clearly. The third week went pretty much the same as the first, except that between classes I spent a lot of time with Jilly Roundtree. Harlan was still away, and I was beginning to wonder if he would ever come back. It was awful to imagine there might be something really wrong with him, but when I asked, there was only the old rumour about him travelling with his parents. I went to classes, listened and took notes, read and joined in, always being careful not to draw too much attention to myself. I walked home every night, slept a lot, worked hard at studying for the coming exams, and whenever I had a quiet hour, I created another piece in my number screen. At home, I studied, cooked, and played with Luke. But by the end of the third week, everything was overshadowed by our excitement about Das' looming gig with Urban Dingo. There were actually going to be two gigs, one on the Friday and one on the Saturday. Both were already completely sold out, apart from a few tickets that would be available at the door on the nights. Da and the band were rehearsing in the shed every day, and then they spent half the night arguing in incomprehensible musical shorthand about the playlist. Excitement spread out from them like a whirlpool, and we were all caught up in it. Miranda, Jessie, Serenity, and I were going to go to the Friday show. I had got enough of my screen built that I felt confident I could cope with anyone talking to me, but the gig would still be a test, because it would be packed, and I still hadn't found a way to protect myself from physical contact. It was not knowing how I would handle myself at the gig that stopped me mentioning it to Jilly, that and a secret fear that losing the rope would bomb. I was ashamed of having so little faith in them, especially since the gigs the band had done until now had always been great. This was a whole different league, because Urban Dingo had just hit the top 10 and were predicted to make number 1 that weekend. Never in my wildest imaginings had I thought of Das' band being mentioned in the same breath as a top 10 mainstream band. I caught the regular afternoon bus on Friday night because I wanted to get home in time to wish Da luck before he left. The show wasn't due to start till late, but bands always had to set up and do sound checks for about 10 hours before they went on stage. They knew we wouldn't see Dar at this gig, except when he was performing. The security was strict, and there would be bouncers and security guards and backstage passes. Not that we would need them, because Irv and Dingo wouldn't be off until 1, and we were supposed to go home before that. Dar was in the kitchen when I got in, having tea and buttered bread, his standard pre-gig fare. "How do you feel?" he asked, when he saw me come in with Miranda. "I caught the bus to save energy for tonight," I told him. I could meet his gaze now, because of the screen, but I was using a thinner bit of it, because there was no point in having extended senses if I dared not make use of them. Dar finished his bread and butter, drained his teacup and said, "Take it easy." "You take it easy," I quipped, and he laughed, giving off coffee grounds and caramelized sugar and the new rope smell that always seemed to come up whenever the band was together or Dar was talking about it. I was close enough to notice that the air was also distorting intensely around him. I had noticed it did that a lot around Dar, but tonight the effect seemed much stronger. The air seemed to be bulging and billowing around him, as if he was sending out invisible rays. Mum came in dressed in a green silk wrapper, her hair piled in this loose, casually perfect tumble, secured by a giant red plastic chopstick. She was yawning, because she had got up after only a few hours' sleep to say goodbye to Dar, but her eyes sparkled with pride as she hugged him, and the drifting clouds that floated and hazed the air about her cleared for a moment when she put her arms around him. I dragged my eyes away from them because they were now staring into one another's eyes in this romantic but terribly embarrassing way. I looked at Jesse, who was totally oblivious to Dar and Mum. He was roasting garlic, his concentration so deep that he might have been cutting the facets of a diamond. Dar had to wave a hand in front of his face to get his attention a minute later. Jesse looked at him blankly for a second, as if he'd forgotten who Dar was. Then he laughed and hugged him, wishing him luck. That was when it hit me that I had been a fool to imagine Jesse was lazy. He looked lazy because he did things slowly and seemed so absent-minded. But there was something going on inside him, inside his mind. That was what I had felt when I brushed against him that first night home from hospital, and whatever was going on with him had reached the point where it needed to come out, but Jesse wasn't letting it. I focused all of my senses on him and let myself really take in the green, wild smell of his essential self. I could feel how poetic and intricate the shapes of his thoughts were, as well as how urgent they had become. "You should write them down," I said, without thinking. My words fell into silence, and they all turned to look at me. "Huh?" Jesse said. I said you ought to write down some of the things you think about." "Jesse, think," cried Miranda, who had just walked in the door. Everyone laughed. Not Jesse. He just went back to shredding lettuce. But I had the feeling he was thinking about what I had said to him, because the green grass smell had got stronger, like freshly mown lawn. That was the only way I could describe it. I was yet again irritated by my lack of words. Miranda frowned at me. "You know something, I'm beginning to understand why you're getting a reputation as a weirdo." She was painting her nails gold to match her toenails, to match her dress, and the current color of her hair. "Gold," she said, "was an evolved form of yellow." "Seriously," she went on, "Sylvia Yarrow told everyone at the pool that Alizon has been taken over by an alien."
"That's a deeply intelligent theory," Dar said, getting a bottle of water out of the fridge.
"Well, you must admit, she's been different since she came out of hospital," Miranda said. One thing I had seen under her surface was that Miranda was kind of blind about how other people reacted to the things she said. I had always thought her bossy and abrasive, but these days I realized she just didn't see how people felt about the things she blurted out, and that made me pity her, like some sort of lame puppy you know is never going to be able to walk properly.
"Miranda," Dar began.
I cut in. "It's okay, she's right about me being different. Knowing I was asleep for a whole month makes me feel like I am seeing things properly for the first time, and maybe that makes me act differently."
How do you mean, seeing things differently?
Dar asked, but the phone rang. It was Serenity, saying she'd missed the bus, and could someone pick her up from the public library? Dar looked at his watch and said he just had time to get her and bring her back before he went to pick up Titch. He pulled on his coat, kissed Mum, and hurried out.
How come Serenity went to the library tonight? Miranda complained to Mum after he'd gone. I thought Monday was her cast iron night.
But Mum was gone, back into the vivid clouds of her imagination.
9.
It was 9 when Jessie drove me and Miranda to the venue. Serenity had announced that she was not going when Dad dropped her home from the library. Dad told her it was up to her, but I smelt an old seashell sort of odour that I felt certain was hurt. I could have strangled Serenity, whose only reason had been that it would be too loud. The old Serenity wouldn't have let that stop her seeing Da. That was one of the things I disliked most about how she had changed. It was as if we didn't matter to her at all any more, not even Da, whom she had once adored as I did. Fortunately, the night was too full of promise for me to brood for long, and Miranda was talking non-stop about some argument she was having with the long-suffering Ricky, which had resulted in him deciding not to meet us at the gig. The dome was a huge concert hall made of steel and plastic. Its front was plastered with posters for Urban Dingo. Millions of neon lights were strategically positioned to cast a ghastly orange and purple glow over the throng of people lined up at the gate, making it look like a sort of end-of-the-world scenario. If anyone had doubted it, the crowd was proof that Urban Dingo had made it. The thought of all these people seeing losing the rope made me feel breathless with excitement and nerves. The band chose losing the rope while Dar and the guys were jamming a lot and talking seriously about forming a band. There was this Swiss guy staying with Mel who had looked like a ski instructor. Whenever he became confused listening to people, which was pretty much all of the time, since he spoke about 10 words of English, he would shout, "Stop! I am losing the rope!" It was so funny that Da and Mel and the others started saying it whenever things got muddled. Then one day, the drummer, Neil Stone, said it would make a good name for their band. Neil is this really huge guy like Meatloaf, and he dresses a lot better. He says he has to be big because Stone is a heavy name to carry. People always say drummers are dumb, but he's really smart and nice, and I love him, though sometimes I worry he might have a heart attack carrying all that extra weight around. It was Neil who later told me that, while I was still unconscious, Urban Dingo's manager wanted to break the contract with losing the rope because his band was suddenly getting so much attention they could probably have asked a bigger name to open for them. Fortunately, Urban Dingo had refused. It took us forever to get a park, and then reach the gate and ask for our free tickets. I don't know why Dad just couldn't give them to us at home, but he claimed it was part of the adventure to scrum for them. Of course, he had no idea how little attraction scrumming had for me right now, and maybe forever. I had never been inside the dome before, but I knew of it as a venue hosting everything from old-time dance marathons to jelly wrestling. Having Urban Dingo was a definite coup for the dome as well. It was a smooth silver dome from without, but inside it was a great circular cave of a place with tiered seating around the edges and a vast central floor. The stage was set up at one end where seats had been removed, and it was swarming with roadies. Quite a few people were down on the floor dancing in demented clots to house music coming over the PA system, while the rest were talking and drinking down near the bar. The music from the PA sounded to me like something alive that had gone crazy from being trapped in a box and was now trying to eat its way out. I recognized the music of the band that had hurt me so much after I had awakened from my coma, The Rack, with its awful earwig music. I put my hands in my pockets to stop myself from putting them over my ears and intensified my scream. I wrinkled my nose because using the screen only dulled the extended part of my senses, not the normal bit. I wish there could be a music scene without smoke machines. If you wanted to hear a band live, you had to put up with it, and it always made me want to sneeze. Of course, it looked great because of the way it extended the light, in this case pink and purple and blue, and the way flashes of light thrown from huge suspended pieces of smashed mirror on the stage cut into it was amazing. Before long, the place was bursting at the seams with crazed